From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm your host, Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're going to take a close look at what is happening with immigration reform. Reform efforts have stalled in the U.S. House of Representatives, but the broken immigration system continues to take its toll on families across the United States. We're joined again today by Mark Alvarez, immigration specialist with Telemundo Utah, to find out how far the country has come and how much further it has to go to tackle this issue.
One statistic, 60% of undocumented immigrants have been in the United States for more than 10 years. They clearly have connections. They have family connections. You just mentioned the mixed families. 4 million children who are U.S. citizens live with undocumented parents.
That conversation and your summary of the day's top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up in just a few moments, we'll be turning to a conversation with attorney Mark Alvarez, an immigration specialist with Telemundo, Utah, to hear about why immigration reform has stalled in the U.S. House of Representatives. But first up, we have these headlines. Utility records show that the National Security Agency's massive data center south of Salt Lake City is using less water than expected. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that Bluffdale City records show monthly water use at the massive $1.7 billion data center peaked last July at 6.2 million gallons. That was below the 1 million gallons daily that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers predicted the center would need to cool its computer processors. NSA officials have refused to say if the center is up and running after its scheduled opening last October was stalled by electrical problems. Records show that the NSA has made contract-required minimum monthly payments to the city, which were about $29,000 a month in July and increased to about $32,000 a month in January of this year. This past weekend's rainstorms helped boost the snowpack in northern Utah, but agricultural officials say southern Utah is still struggling with extreme drought. 12 Utah counties were declared drought disasters in January. The canyons east of Salt Lake County now report about 75% snowpack, while the low-elevation drainages on the Wasatch Front are only producing about 50% of normal. National Weather Service hydrologist Brian McInerney tells KSL-TV that the hardest-hit areas are central and southern Utah, where water supply forecasts are as low as 15%. Northern Utah was headed for trouble, too, before a series of February storms delivered as much as 2 feet of water in some places. Without that, hydrologists say water supply would have been only 30 or 40% of normal in northern Utah. And finally today, Mormon church statistics show the historic increase in Mormon missionaries around the world hasn't led to an immediate spike in converts, though church officials say it's too early to draw conclusions. After lowering the minimum age for missionaries, the number of proselytizing members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints increased by 41% in 2013. The number of converts, however, only increased by 4% last year. A church membership analyst said the low conversion rates may be because the bulk of the missionaries are serving in areas with historically low conversion rates. Church officials say it's problematic to make any assessments based on the figures, since many of the missionaries didn't start their service until summer or later. Men serve 2 years and women serve 18 months. That does it for our summary of the day's top headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Rundown. Now on the show, we're going to take a look at what's happening with immigration reform. Why is it stalled in the House of Representatives, and where does Utah's delegation in Washington stand on the issue? And what about the case of Ana Cañenguez, one-time Utah Head Start Parent of the Year, who, along with four of her six children, is facing imminent deportation? To untangle these and other questions, we're joined now by Mark Alvarez, an attorney and an immigration specialist with Telemundo, Utah. He's also the host of the Spanish-language radio program Sin Rodeos on La Jefa Radio here in Salt Lake City. Mark Alvarez, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
I wanted to begin by asking you, what has happened with immigration reform? There was some big movement last year, including the passage of a reform bill by the Senate. But where are we now?
Well, right now, we have supposedly a majority of people in the House of Representatives who would vote for immigration reform, but a Republican leadership that's stopping a vote. And so right now, there's a discharge petition going around with over 190 signatures. It would have to get to 218 to allow a direct vote on immigration reform in the House of Representatives. But immigration reform is stuck in the House of Representatives because Republican leadership does not want to allow it to go forward.
So they're not allowing a vote, but there are the votes to actually get immigration reform passed should the leadership say, yes, we'll do this.
I believe so. Most commentators and most House specialists are saying, yes, there are the votes to pass immigration reform. But many Republicans who support immigration reform seem reluctant to expose themselves to primary challenges and also to expose themselves to anti-immigrant elements that might try to undermine their campaigns going into the elections in November 2014.
You know, I want to get to that political aspect of this issue in a moment, but I thought we could go back to something you said, which was this discharge petition. You said there are 190 signatures or over 190 signatures. They need to get to 218 to have the discharge petition go into effect. What would it do?
If there are a majority of people in the House of Representatives who sign a discharge petition, it can allow a bill to go to a vote on the floor of the House of Representatives without going through all the committee procedures. And so essentially what a discharge petition would do is bypass the leadership of Speaker John Boehner, Speaker Boehner being the Republican who is one of a group of people who have held up immigration reform. That said, I don't think he's opposed to immigration reform. But as the leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, he's seen it as politically wise to stop a vote from going forward on broad immigration reform.
Hmm. About 28 signatures left for discharge petition. Is that going to happen?
Bluntly, no. I don't think it will, because even Republicans who support immigration reform will be reluctant to sign a discharge petition, which essentially is a direct challenge at the leadership of that person's own party. And so the discharge petition was an interesting tactic that was used by the Democratic Party to bring back the conversation about immigration reform and also to emphasize the necessity of immigration reform for business reasons, for political reasons, frankly, for diplomatic reasons. But the discharge petition was probably not likely to have success. And I think the people who presented it knew that.
Okay, so bringing pressure to bear, that's something that's been happening in other manners as well. In the past few months, the president has been meeting with activists and lately with religious leaders, including the LDS Church's Dieter Uchtdorf. This is just last week. The president's hope is to pressure the House to act on immigration reform. Is that working at all?
So far, it really hasn't worked that well from the president's side. So the president actually, I think wisely, has given the Republican Party space to try to get to a vote on immigration reform. He stayed in the background because Republicans, especially anti-immigrant Republicans, have used Obama as the weapon against those who might vote for immigration reform. Why would we give President Obama a legislative victory? A lot of Republicans have used the line, we don't trust Obama because he's been soft on immigration policy. Interesting, because a lot of activists have pointed out how there have been 2 million deportations during the Obama administration. So for me, it seems, frankly, it seems hypocritical to complain about Obama because he hasn't delivered on his promise of immigration reform, and yet to blame him on trust, he's the reason why we can't vote for immigration reform.
It's interesting, though, that he wants to be seen as being distant from it to allow it to proceed a little bit further forward. Is that the idea?
I believe so. I believe President Obama has been very clear. Immigration reform is not a Democratic Party issue. Some Democrats have tried to hide this a bit, but President Bush was a very strong proponent of immigration reform, George W. Bush.
Right.
Even in 2001, President Bush met with Vicente Fox in the White House just before September 11th and spoke about a warming relationship with Mexico.
This is the former president of Mexico.
Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico. Bush talked about the possibility of immigration reform. Unfortunately, the events of September 11th, 2001, killed any real chance of immigration reform in Bush's first term. And in his second term, a lot of political games were played. That said, it was Republicans, by and large, who blocked immigration reform in 2005, 2006, and 2007.
I mean, politics is always playing a hand here. Just on Friday at a press conference that Senator Orrin Hatch was at, including a number of business people from the tech sector and Draper talking about high-tech jobs and the need to increase the number of H-1B visas. The Salt Lake Tribune quotes Hatch as saying, the fact is that the House is not going to pass immigration reform until after the primary season is over. What that kind of implies is that once the primary season is over, they will pass immigration reform. Can you separate politics from lawmaking to take a rational approach to this and just leave politics to the side, or is that just the way our system works?
Yeah, I know. I sure wish we could, because I think on intelligence, on substance, immigration reform, as far as substance goes, is known already. modernization of the visa systems, increases in some of the quotas for H-1B visas, which Hatch mentioned those last week. Back in 2006, a six-month quota of H-1B visas was used up in a day or two. And so this is nothing new. There's going to have to be some type of a modernization as far as our border security goes, probably entry-exit systems, employment verification, and a legalization program. The substance of immigration reform is very well known and has been known for a long time. It's the politics of it that are terrible. Right now, I think most of the conversation, even from the Republican side that's trying to undermine Obama, even though they say they'd like to see immigration reform, I think this is a fight for credit. And unfortunately, politics often comes down to that. Who's going to be able to put on the medals at the end of the day?
I'm kind of wondering about the positions of Utah's elected officials. And Mark, I don't know how deeply you can go into this, but if we include Senator Hatch, who did, by the way, vote for the Senate reform bill, what is the position of Utah's delegation in Washington on the issue of immigration reform?
Well, Mike Lee has spoken in piecemeal ways about immigration reform. He's tried to be positive, but he in 2010 won his Senate seat by using the term anchor baby. He won his Senate seat by engaging in a terribly anti-immigrant campaign. He was a member of the Gang of Eight in the U.S. Senate. At the end of 2012, they was going to work on an immigration reform package. He bailed on it when he saw that they were getting close to an agreement. He voted against immigration reform. So I consider Mike Lee one of the most anti-immigrant people in the U.S. Congress, certainly in the Utah delegation. Bishop, Chaffetz, and Stewart have spoken positively about some aspects of immigration reform, but they voted lockstep with the Republican Party to keep votes from happening. Jim Matheson voted against the DREAM Act in 2010. He's been completely silent on immigration reform. At this point, I consider Matheson also an obstacle to immigration reform. So we have an entire congressional delegation, except for Hatch, who's opposed to immigration reform. Interestingly, it kind of puts the lie to the idea that Utah is friendly on immigration.
But I wanted to ask you about the there was the guest worker program that Utah enacted a few years ago. The state legislature again this year voted to postpone this law. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit and Utah's perceived friendliness towards immigration reform and what you think about that.
Well, in 2010, a group of people tried to put forth this idea that Utah could forge a solution on immigration. It was unconstitutional from the beginning. Mark Shurtleff, Luis Robles, Gary Herbert all spoke about this Utah solution and about delivering on immigration at the state level. They all made the claim, we're going to go to the federal government and get a waiver to put in this Utah pilot program. There were no waivers available in immigration law. Didn't matter. They went ahead and passed a package in 2011. The implementation date was 2013. 2 years ago, they pushed back the implementation date.
By a year.
This year, they pushed back the implementation date to 2017. Not only that, Kurt Bramble in the Capitol said this is not a workable program. For tax reasons, also for constitutional reasons, it's not a workable program. So I think the delay on that guest worker program, the Utah solution on immigration that Mark Shurtleff, Luis Robles, and Gary Herbert, and the LDS Church, the Utah Compact people raved about it, that's turned out to be a failure. Or it certainly turned out to be not practical, not constitutional.
Well, and you say not constitutional, and one of the reasons for that is because it was the state granting a status to people that they don't really have the right to grant a status to. This is squarely in the purview of the federal government and not of the state.
And that's the problem with the Utah Compact. The Utah Compact was a copy of a document from the Enrich in Utah Coalition. It was published in 2009. It was plagiarized in part and Mormonized in other parts. The real problem with the Utah Compact is it fudged on the federal authority. It tried to carve out a state authority. On the enforcement side, there actually is a little bit of room for states to act on immigration, to beef up enforcement. It's unfortunate from my side. I would love to see broad immigration reform, but there is some scope on the enforcement side. On the benefit side, as far as a work permit, there's none. 8 U.S.C. 1324A prohibits employers from hiring people without documents. That's a federal law. States granting work permits would essentially be granting permits to employers to directly violate that federal law, 8 U.S.C. 1324A. That's violative of the Constitution under the Supremacy Clause.
I get that, and I understand that that definitely is not a constitutional way of going about it. But what I'm wondering about is the language itself and how Utah is perceived as a leader on the issue of immigration because of the sort of compassionate language of the Utah Compact, et cetera. Is that having some kind of maybe intangible effect?
It may. I think your point's a very good one. For practical reasons, the law that the Utah Compact backed up was a non-starter from the very beginning. As far as the conversation, I think there may be something to the fact that a conservative state could have a conversation about immigration and they could actually come up with something positive. The real problem was the false hope that was given to people, because when the Utah scheme passed, false hope was given in a lot of the undocumented community that work permits would be available. The other problem is this. That document worked for image, and a lot of it, frankly, is Mormon-owned media that spread the idea of Utah being a friendly state across the country, and some of it's reflected glory. It had an effect as far as Utah's image. It didn't have any real practical effect. Did the document from 2010, 3.5 years later, did it have that effect of getting the Utah congressional delegation to push for a solution that would be in accordance with Utah values? I don't think it did. I actually think a more honest conversation would have been better. In fact, a few years ago, I actually gave testimony in the Capitol. Mike Wattups, the Senate president, asked me directly, "You're telling us this is unconstitutional. I think he saw you make a lot of sense. What do you propose?" I said, "I don't really have anything to propose at the state level because there's not much you can do. But one step I would propose, be honest. Utah employers need the undocumented workers. The LDS Church is working to expand in Latin America. It doesn't want to be seen as unfriendly on immigration issues. Just be honest about that. Utah needs immigration reform for economic reasons, perhaps for religious reasons, even to make this a civil conversation."
Now that we're at a point where this bill is stagnating in the House, going back to the national level, people have been pushing for the Obama administration to take some steps to slow deportations. This is kind of in the meantime, and expand some visa programs while we don't have any action on immigration reform. But leaders from the immigrant community have lately called the president, quote, deporter in chief. We talked about this a little bit. It's a catchy title. I'm wondering if it's an accurate title.
I don't think it is. I think that Obama certainly deserves some blame for not having pushed immigration reform. He may deserve some blame for the high number of deportations, but it's misleading to call him deporter-in-chief because he's not completely responsible for those deportations. There's a union in ICE that is pushed very, very hard to make sure the government doesn't require them to deport fewer people. Republicans have fanned that. In fact, I can't remember the name of the person, but the president of that union actually sued Obama a few years ago because he claimed the president wasn't allowing ICE agents to do their job. The Congress passed rules requiring a certain number of beds to be occupied by immigrant detainees. Well, if that's the case, are they to blame a bit as well? The bottom line, Obama at this point is standing for immigration reform, and he stood for immigration reform during the 2012 campaign. His opponent was the self-deportation candidate. He did break his promise in 2008 to push immigration reform in his first year, and I think he does deserve some criticism for that, for not having pushed more forcefully for immigration reform earlier in his presidency. But as far as saying he's the worst president in history for deportations, he's a deporter-in-chief, I think that's unfair criticism.
They say that he expended quite a bit of his political capital on the health care reform bill.
Yes, and dealing with an economic crisis. While I've been critical of Obama for not having fulfilled his promise from 2008 to push immigration reform in the first year of his presidency, I'm aware the health care issue became very big. Also, the economic crisis he had to deal with was incredible.
Mark, on a kind of more personal note related to immigration reform, and this is just one of many stories, the Tribune ran a story on Sunday, I think it was, maybe it was Saturday, on the story of Ana Cañengas, a mother who, along with her four teenage sons, is slated to be deported soon. Meanwhile, her two younger children will remain here because they are U.S. citizens born in Utah. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which we were just talking about, says she was detained at the border not long ago, and that makes her a priority for deportation. Kanyengwa says that going back to El Salvador means that her teenage sons are at high risk of gang violence. This is one of those stories that kind of brings home what's happening because of the broken immigration system. A lot of families are being split up, and some of that is because you have families that are comprised of half legal or even citizens and half, you know, non-citizens. Can you address these tragic personal stories that are occurring, Mark?
Well, they're heartbreaking stories, and there are so many of them. That's the nightmare of immigration. I think a lot of attorneys, and I definitely include myself in this, we want this over just to stop the nightmare. I want to get out of immigration and be able to do something else, education, fitness, or something else, because it's just a nightmare to hear story after story of heartbreak. One statistic, 60% of undocumented immigrants have been in the United States for more than 10 years. They clearly have connections. They have family connections. You just mentioned the mixed families. 4 million children who are U.S. citizens live with undocumented parents. This happens all the time. Very sad cases. In the case of Anna Kanyengith, and not to go into too much detail about the case, it involves asylum claims as well, aggravated reentry. The problem with asylum is you have to prove a well-founded fear of persecution based on race, religion, nationality, membership in a social group, or political opinion. If the well-founded fear of persecution doesn't fit easily into one of those five categories, very difficult to make the case. High crime is not a reason that justifies an asylum. If high crime were a justification for an asylum claim, and somebody from El Salvador made the claim, anybody from El Salvador could make exactly the same claim.
Precedent.
You have to show a particular well-founded fear of persecution. It's not a general fear of persecution that anybody in the country would feel.
Mm. Well, okay, we're a bit over our time here, but I wanted to ask, there's been a review of deportation policies going on. The president ordered a review of deportation policies, and Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson is said to be weighing a proposal to limit the deportations of immigrants living in the U.S. illegally who don't have serious criminal records. The Associated Press says that that could shield, quote, tens of thousands of immigrants now removed each year solely because they committed repeat immigrant violations, such as reentering the country illegally after having been deported or failing to comply with a deportation order. This is kind of the case of Kanyengwa herself. The Republican Party says that those kinds of proposals go too far. The immigrant community says it doesn't go far enough. They want to see an expansion to the Deferred Action Program, for example. I mean, is there a middle ground where the kind of enforcement of deportation while immigration reform stalls can be modified?
Well, to start, I favor immigration reform that would cover almost everybody who's here without documents, except those with very serious criminal records. Hmm. That said, it bothers me a bit to see pressure on the president to carry out a style of immigration reform by executive order. There are constitutional issues with that. There's a saying in law, hard cases make bad law. We need systematic reform. And so I firmly believe that the pressure has to remain on the Congress to carry out immigration reform that would apply to everybody who's here without documents in the country, not necessarily granting them status, but let's have a systematic change in broken immigration law. That said, it's hard when you see a case like Anna Kanyengith because she shouldn't have to leave. In my opinion, she shouldn't have to leave. There are a lot of other people who should not have to leave. Asking President Obama to address these cases by executive action is a little bit dangerous in my mind for constitutional reasons. That said, if Republicans continue to refuse to act on immigration reform, it might be a situation in which the urgency and the gravity of the problem leads me to say, well, no, Obama has to act. He's acting out of necessity. He's acting because of a humanitarian crisis. Mm. It bothers me because the change should come from the Congress. There should be broad immigration reform. Executive action can only be a temporary patch to the broken immigration system. Barack Obama cannot carry out immigration reform on his own, which I think is something some activists who very strongly go after Obama don't get.
Well, and then, I mean, okay, and you have Hatch, for example, on Friday saying, as I said, that the House isn't going to do anything about this until after primary season is over. There is this kind of long meantime. I mean, it's not that long, but also time is running out for this Congress in particular to get this issue taken care of. Waiting until after the primary season's over only gives them a matter of months, really.
I think in most people are talking about votes perhaps in June, July, maybe August. Mm. There's also talk about trying to deal with this in a lame duck session. That seems far-fetched to me, but immigration has challenged a lot of realities of people. Certainly, I thought immigration reform would pass last year after it had so much momentum, passing through the U.S. Senate on June 27th. I thought the House of Representatives would be more serious in tackling that issue. They weren't. Who knows how they'll deal with it this year. I think there's still a pretty good chance of immigration reform passing. That said, and this is where I go back to Obama, if immigration reform does not pass, I think the president should do something, and frankly, I think he will.
Mark Alvarez is an attorney and an immigration specialist with Telemundo Utah. Mark, there's a lot that we didn't get around to talking about, but we are out of time. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You can find this interview and all of our past episodes of The Rundown at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for a conversation about e-cigarettes with Dr. David Abrams of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.